Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Okay, so I am coming to... This is Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure.
You almost forgot who you were.
I almost forgot. You have me so... I'm like so in the midst of a romance here. I'm in the back... Like probably the prettiest backyard I've ever been to. And I feel so honored to be here with a man that impressed me with his talents for a couple of decades now, Aaron Pott. He has many roles, and we were talking about how important being a father and a husband is, but he also has almost a paternal relationship with his vineyard. He's a vineyardist and vigneron first and foremost, and then of course an exceptional winemaker that's very, very highly thought after with a lot of illustrious clients. Extremely diversified portfolio of wines with all kinds of things that are so intriguing and interesting and delicious, and we're going to talk about hopefully a good portion of that. For those of you that don't know Aaron, I would love to learn, how did your journey start? Like, where were you born? Where did it all begin?
I was born in Eugene, Oregon. My father was a Presbyterian minister, but he had done a PhD in theology at the University of Edinburgh. And he... always had a church, but he always had a church in a college town so that he could alternately teach at the university in that town. And so that sort of framed my youth. And one of the wonderful things that happened to my father is that he did a postdoctorate at the University of Heidelberg in Germany.
Oh, wow.
And he had a professor there who was a huge wine lover and made my father a wine lover too. And through the easiest, if the drug dealers have a first one's free idea, it has to be the sweet German wines.
The gateway wine.
Yeah, the gateway drug are those sweet German wines. And my father was taken by those wonderful sweet German wines, and I remember as a kid that we would get a little taste of those every once in a while, and they were perfect wines for kids to start with because they are sweet, ideal for a child's palate. They have a great deal of acidity, but they also have very low alcohols,
yeah.
So they're incredibly accessible for kids. And I grew up in a house that was in the front had a very rural golf course, and in the back just the endless eastern woods of Oregon.
Wow.
So very lovely childhood running around.
You know, that's so good to hear. I often speak of a lot of American households tend to be more on the puritanical side, particularly in certain states. You obviously grew up in a house where people, you know, that were raising you, they were very open-minded, weren't they? I mean, what you describe in your experiences, there's a lot of freedom, a lot of interaction, early exposure to wine. Is that correct?
Or? Yeah, and I'm, you know, my father was a minister, you know, very, very religious person. But for him, his idea of religion was that Christ brought love, and that was the message was love. And I think he very much thought that that was the message he wanted to bring. And he was very active in politics, very active in the civil rights movement, active in later on in gay rights, women's rights, and so on. He would sort of pick every decade a new oppressed people to support, and was very active in that. So yeah, it was a very loving family. My mother was a school teacher.
Oh wow.
And so very, very close. I had two sisters and a brother, and we were very rarely separated. So
yeah, it's a very close,
tight family, a lot of love.
Wow, and that sounds wonderful.
I mean, I think my wine journey really started, and it's kind of an old story at this point, but my parents did a 2-year sabbatical in Oxford, England, mm-hmm. and during that trip, we took a holiday on the continent, and the first place we ended up was in Paris.
Wow.
And the first night I was in Paris at a venerable bistro, I ordered a glass of milk, and the waiter looked at me and said, "Milk is for babies," and brought out a glass of wine, which to this day I assume was Beaujolais.
Wow.
And I remember it tasting bitter and horrible, and but in the back of my mind, this was the thing that was going to make me an adult, and every 9-year-old kid wants to be an adult. And so it was really that moment that instilled in me that, you know, wine is something that adults drink, that adults do, and it's something I need to know about. And I learned everything I could about wine after that trip. It was a trip we visited a lot of different wine regions as well, and I saw that everybody that we visited had sort of three things that I really liked. They had a job where they worked outside. They usually lived in these spectacular chateaux, and they always had dogs with them. So it was, as a child, you're kind of, you see people at work, adults at work, and you think, well, this kind of work I could do. You know, I couldn't see myself typing at a desk or wearing a suit or something like that. But that I could do. I could be outside.
There's something so powerful about that initial connection that could have stayed with you.
Yes. But I think that experience really led me to learn as much as I could about wine. And then I just became that annoying kid at my parents' parties that knew everything about wine and would correct the adults when they made some sort of error.
It's pretty remarkable at the age of 9, and subsequently you're already becoming, you know, an expert of sorts and learning the lingo. And I'm very impressed that you started this young, and clearly there's a follow-through, because here we are today. So where did you go to school?
So I, right out of high school, my family was living in Davis, California.
Okay, well,
and
there you go.
Right out of high school, I went straight to UC Davis.
So there's not even any other thought? You knew that you were headed that way?
No, I knew it's exactly what I wanted to do, and didn't look back.
Okay.
So I did an undergraduate degree in enology, fermentation science, as they called it then. And I was highly influenced by a guy who was a really amazing viticulturalist, a guy named Kees van Leeuwen, who was for many years the viticulturalist at Cheval Blanc. And Case suggested that if I were to really want to learn about making wine and about growing wine, that I should learn about growing Pinot Noir.
Really?
So he encouraged me to go to the University of Burgundy and pursue a master's degree in viticulture there.
That's really quite intense. You know, you went for it all right away.
Yes, yeah. And I landed my first job in the wine industry in 1990, working for John Kongsgaard.
There's a name that carries some power.
And that was a fabulous... fabulous appointment. I mean, I didn't know John at all, and I was sort of forced upon him by the owners of Newton Vineyard.
Yeah.
And John called me up, and after he had heard I was forced on him as his assistant winemaker, he called me up and said, the Newtons have hired you, but I can still veto that. And I
totally see him saying
I
it.
Want, yeah, and you know, very, it wasn't looking good for me at that point. And so he was very stern on the phone and said, we need to meet. And so I drove up to St. Helena to meet him at Newton Vineyard. And for some reason, I was listening at the time to classical music. And I was, you know, had really gotten into classical music. And mainly because my parents were into it, but John's a huge fan of classical music, and I had Mahler's Fifth Symphony blaring in my car as I drove up the driveway to Newton Vineyard, and this tall, handsome Norwegian guy comes out.
It's very imposing, yes.
of his office. And sees my car in the parking lot, and I roll down the window with this music still blaring. Mm-hmm. And I ask him, do you know where John Konsgaard is? And mm-hmm. he says, Mahler's Fifth Symphony.
Nice.
And he says,
love that.
You're Aaron. And I say, yeah, I'm Aaron. And he says, okay, you're hired.
That was so.
It was exciting. That was a very easy meeting.
That's awesome.
And a great experience. I mean, working with John, he was willing to share everything, and made me feel very comfortable right away. Brought me into his home, and I befriended his wife Maggie, whom I love dearly, and his kids. And it was a wonderful learning experience. I mean, just being able to learn about vineyards, being able to learn about wine, and being able to be in the presence of a real master.
Yes.
And then on top of that, we had consulting winemakers at Newton Vineyard that they spared no expense having come over. So we had Dominique Lafont, and then, of course, Michel Roland.
Of course.
So
you couldn't script this any better. I mean, this was really just such a remarkable set of mentors that I'm sure had, you know, a lifetime imprint on how you think of this craft.
Yeah, and I've always been very lucky with that. I mean, just finding the people to learn from that had the knowledge and were willing, that were at a moment in their life that they were willing to disseminate that knowledge.
You know, Newton comes up a lot in people's careers. It's almost like the Kevin Bacon analogy, when you only so far. There's always a connection to Newton, and they were so seminal in establishing, you know, sort of this space for people like you to really learn and hone their craft. And they seem to have established kind of like an incubator of extraordinary talent.
Yeah, I mean, great, great talent. I mean, I think of the people that were there when I was there, or that preceded me. You know, you have Rick Foreman, you mm-hmm. have Dean Sylvester, people that came after me, Andy Erickson, mm-hmm. Luc Morlaix, Jean Hofflinger, uh-huh. and just an incredible stable of real talent.
Well, your French pronunciation is perfect, which leads me to the next stage of, I know you've lived in France and you speak perfect French. Is that the case? I haven't heard you speak, so I have to ask. I'm just noting the pronunciation.
I speak
of the
French.
Name.
Yes. Okay. Perfect.
Maybe not for the French standard, but I'm sure for the rest of us it would sound
with an American accent.
Yes. So how is it that you wound up in Bordeaux?
Well, that was really that was really Michel.
Okay.
Michel Roland, at the time he was consulting for Newton Vineyard, he only had two consulting clients in mm-hmm. California, Simi and Newton. And he would come out for three weeks at a time, and mm-hmm. he would stay and was completely bored. He would work all day, and then he would go back to his hotel room and do absolutely nothing.
Uh-huh.
And so I started inviting him to things, mm-hmm. and bringing friends by that had wines that he couldn't possibly find in Bordeaux. You know, that only crazy American collectors had, and old things and wonderful treasures from cellars, and I would cook him very simple French meals. You know, the best way to a Frenchman's heart is through his stomach, as they say. And
I think that's male population in general. But
indeed, I think you're right.
But no, you're right. That's huge brownie points right there.
But so eventually I got the courage, and I remember I was at dinner at John Kongsgaard's house, in which we tasted all of the great 82 Bordeaux's.
Oh my.
And had several older Bordeaux's, as well as a lot of crazy German wines. And everybody was feeling good. And I said to Michel, you know, Michel, do you think you could find me a job working in Bordeaux? Because I would love to go over there and mm-hmm. and work. And Michel said, I will look for you. So a few weeks later, he had returned to France, and he called me up on the phone and said, I have the perfect job for you. And I had no idea what I was getting into. I really, in my mind, I wanted to go over there and work in a cellar and just be part of what was going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe get paid and hopefully have free lodging and maybe a bicycle to get to work or something like that. And Michel said, you know, buy your ticket, and this woman is going to call you on the phone and arrange for you to be picked up at the airport. And I said, okay, you know, this sounds great. And so I get this call from this woman with this incredibly deep, very sexy voice. And she says, I will be there to pick you up at the airport.
Oh, things just got better. It's looking like it's and looking up even more.
I arrived in Bordeaux and I was picked up by at the airport by Christine Vallette. And Christine was the manager and part owner. It was all Trolot Mondeau at the time was owned by Christine and her two siblings,
okay.
brother and sister, and she was in charge of managing it. Michel was consulting for them, and I didn't realize that I was applying for the job of winemaker at Trolot Mondeau until we actually rolled up to the chateau. And,
oh my lord. So you're a little surprised, huh?
Yeah, I mean, more than a little surprised. You know, I was 25 years old at the time, and, you know, working at a Grand Cru Classé Chateau was a total dream, but running a Grand Cru Classé Chateau, that wasn't wasn't exactly what I was ready for.
You must have impressed the living daylights out of Michel. There's no way he would have recommended you for this job if that wasn't the case.
It was crazy. Yeah, it was really crazy. I mean, I think what Michel saw in me was that everything that he said, I would write down. And when we were at Newton, I was so lucky that John would bring me along, and I would be in the back of, John had a little Ford Ranger pickup. And John, who's, you know, 6'4", 6'5", maybe, in the front seat, and Michel in the passenger seat. And then there were these two little jump seats in the back that you could fold down. And so I would fold down one and put my feet on the other and just take notes, most of which I still have, these old notes. But I think Michel thought that I was a very good note taker and thought that I would be perfect for these slightly quirky people that were looking to do things very differently than the rest of the region.
So when you say do things differently, specifically, were they looking to modernize their wine, or what was it that they were after?
I think that they felt that Saint-Emilion was somewhat provincial.
Uh-huh.
And I think they were really looking to expand the presence of Saint-Emilion outside of...
To make it more cosmopolitan.
Make it more cosmopolitan, mm-hmm. make it more worldly.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, it's hard to take a wine that's so stamped by its terroir.
Yeah.
And make it anything different, you know.
Yeah.
Wines like that, there's so much that the terroir is giving the wine that any attempt at creating a style for it is a total failure.
Do you feel that it's also that they're so tethered to that character, that is there any challenge in that? Not necessarily a negative side, but when you're so committed to that particular notion of who you are as a brand because of, you know, the terroir, the land that shows up in the wine so powerfully, and not really feeling empowered to tweak it. Do you think that there's any trouble in that?
I don't. I mean, I think what makes wine unique and what makes wine interesting and what makes wine different is that effect of terroir.
Okay.
And I think the more we try to mess with that, the more we sort of lose the focus of what the wine is.
Okay. So what was your imprint on that brand?
I was just a passing wind.
Oh, I doubt that.
Today it's a Premier Grand Cru Classé.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's been sold to an insurance company. They've made millions of euros of investment in the mm-hmm. in the wine. It's a totally different world in Saint-Emilion. I think my contribution to that was very little. I like to think, I mean, they had to taste the wines that I made in order to mm-hmm. in order to pass to Premier Grand Cru Classé, but I think I was a very small part of that. I mean, the bigger picture is the land.
Yeah.
And I took more from Trolan Mondo than I gave to Trolan Mondo. I learned more living in Saint-Emilion, living in Bordeaux in that decade. I learned so much because it was a decade of real change and real they made so many leaps forward in terms of technology and mm-hmm. understanding wine and understanding grape growing, understanding viticulture, that there are lessons that I learned in the decade of the 90s that people are just learning in Napa Valley today.
Really? So, they were that much further ahead?
Yeah. I mean, I really think they were, and they were further ahead because they had unified the idea of winemaking and grape growing.
Okay, so and the concept of vineyard own had a foothold forever. There was really no other way.
Yeah, and I mean, these are, you know, Trolan Mondo was not a small property. It's a very large property, 33 hectares. A massive property by Saint-Emilion standards, but most of the properties are, you know, around 10 hectares. And so quite small, family-owned properties, generally family-run properties. That certainly has changed since that era.
And what about this, you were describing winds of change and just very dynamic environment. Has that continued or has it been replaced by something?
No, I mean, I think... Bordeaux, was slapped in the face, resting on its laurels by an upstart California region called Napa Valley. And I think we really, it took them a long time to stand up and see it, but I think we really kind of blindsided them. And changed how people perceive wine for a long time.
When did you think that awareness start to sink in Bordeaux that California is a real player?
I think it was really in that decade of the 90s that California became a real player. And I don't think it was until the end of the decade that that Saint-Emilion, that the Médoc really said, "Ah, wow, these guys are they're starting to get good."
Yeah.
and I think it was not the wines that had traditionally been made in Napa Valley, the big producers' wines that changed the game. It was small producers in Napa Valley that really set their standards high and I think really changed the game.
So, but you're not necessarily referring to the cult wines that...
I think the cult wines are a big, you know, the early cult wines are a big factor.
You know, the Harlins, the Colgans, the Arajos.
The Harlins, the Colgans, yeah. The Arajos, I think those are all a big factor.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly a lot of those wines, you know, you look at something like Arajo, I mean, the Isley Vineyard was making great wines. You try the 1971 Ridge Isley Vineyard.
That's why people forget. It didn't start with Bard and Daphne.
Spectacular wine.
Yeah.
I mean, unbelievable wine. Mm-hmm. One of the best Cabernets, I would say, in the top 10 of the great Cabernets I've had in my life.
Yeah.
And I think people were discovering these great vineyards again.
Yeah.
And realizing that, you know, if we start limiting production, if we start looking at these things under a microscope, we can really start making something good. You know, and they're, I think that's continued, you know, the wines of Colgan are fabulous. The wines from that Isley Vineyard, they're still fabulous. You know, you try the wines of Dalla Valle, they're wonderful wines.
God, yeah.
Maya is a wonderful wine.
Yeah.
I don't think that's changed. I mean, I think we've rediscovered some of the older wines that have been kind of lost, you know, things like Maya Comus that were fabulous wines in the 60s and 70s. I mean, you try the older 60s wines from late 60s wines from Chapelet and early 70s wines up there, they're fabulous. I mean, that was, you know, going on way before Pritchard Hill became Millionaire's Alley or whatever they want to call it these
Rodeo
days.
Drive.
Rodeo Drive.
Yes. It's a Beverly Hill now. no, it's... so what you're describing is that California was already predisposed without the awareness factor by virtue of the vineyards and terroir that existed long ago and pre-phylloxera and all that stuff. But when people started exploring it, and, you know, really embraced it and applied the correct viticultural practices, that's when it flourished. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and I think part of that is, I mean, there's a serious French influence there. There's a serious Russian influence there with
Andre. Andre's listening, I hope. It's a good conversation.
Yeah, I mean, who was Cyclops in The Land of the Blind, that guy.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.